Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Everybody, welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Michelle Black. Being a Gold Star brother, Michelle and I share a distinction that no one wants to have by being a Gold Star family member. Michelle is a Gold Star widow whose husband, Brian Black, was killed in 2017 in Africa under some rather unusual circumstances, which I'm sure we'll get to in just a bit. She's also the author of the book Sacrifice, which is an in-depth, basically an after-action report that came out of the attack that killed her husband and the events that followed after that. So welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really appreciative of being here. Look forward to this talk.
I always like I said before we started recording here, I always like having people who have a story to tell and people like yourself who are fortunate enough to be able to tell a story in place of someone who's no longer here to be able to tell their own story. And, you know, I think that that's something that needs to be done. These stories need to be told. And I'm always happy to have people like yourself on who are willing to share their loved one's stories. So for those who aren't familiar with you and your story, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So my name is Michelle Black, and as you stated earlier, I am a widow. My husband, Brian Black, was killed in October 4th, 2017, when his Green Beret team was ambushed just outside of Tongo Tongo, Niger in Africa. He was killed along with three other Americans and five Nigerians. So that day we lost my husband, Staff Sergeant Brian Black, Staff Sergeant Dustin Wright, Sergeant First Class Jeremiah Johnson, and Sergeant LeDavid Johnson. It was the largest loss of life on the continent of Africa since the Battle of Mogadishu, also known as Black Hawk Down. And so it instantly became a huge national media story, especially with Trump being president. Everybody was certain, you know, I think they coined the term, this was Trump's Benghazi. And so the media went crazy with it. There were multiple things over about 8 months of investigating that happened. Trump called the family members. There was an argument between him and one of the widows. Then the media started saying that this was a team who were a bunch of cowboys that had gone rogue to wanting to hunt down a terrorist. On a kill capture mission, basically trying to trick their higher ups. And then there was a video, a head cam video that was stolen off the body of Sergeant First Class Jeremiah Johnson by the militants, and they made a propaganda video out of it, which CBS News then released on TV, and which, by the way, you know, multiple people saw, and I detail that in my book about like my husband's mom coming home from work and seeing her son die on national TV. So then that spread across YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, I mean, every form of social media, and still it pops up all the time. I'm pretty sure my children have seen it, at least my oldest autistic son. So they get the option of seeing their dad shot in the head anytime they want. And then AFRICOM ran an investigation into themselves. And when we were finally briefed 7 months after the fact, they lied to us. And then the commander of AFRICOM went on national TV and said, my husband's team was not indicative of what special operators do. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is a lot. And this, again, this is all detailed in your book. I listened to your book. I got the audio version of it, but it's an incredibly detailed account of what took place, not only just, you know, on the battlefield where this took place, but also what took place afterwards, the investigations, the reports that came out, and the things like the media coverage and how they released the this propaganda footage that was taken, you know, off of one of the soldiers. It went through all of that. And one of the things that I think your book does really, really well, it does a lot well, but one of the things is it lives up to its title, Sacrifice. Not only do you paint a clear picture of the sacrifice that's made when the soldiers are away from family on training or deployments, which is typical, you kind of expect that in the military, but also the sacrifice that the families make when they don't make it home, and when the soldiers don't make it home, I should say. There's an awful lot of sacrifice being made all around throughout the military. You know, tell us about that kind of angle of it. Like, what is the purpose behind the book? You know, I know you are trying to get the truth and the information out there, but you did more than that. And I think you talked a lot about the sacrifices that were made. How did that come about in terms of the book writing process?
So I really wanted to do several things with this book, and I'm glad to hear that I did them well, because that was my goal. You hear constantly, bridge the gap, bridge the gap. How are we going to bridge the gap between the civilian and the military world? And I came from, I grew up about as far from the military as a person could. I didn't even know anyone who was in the military at all growing up. And my dad was like, don't marry somebody in the military, because then they are just gone all the time. They're basically marrying and leaving you. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, then I marry Brian. And then, you know, a couple of years later, he joins the military. And my dad was not happy about that. He was like, no. But yeah, I grew up, you know, in California, where, you know, just, you know, we were all about sports and out having fun, and service wasn't part of that equation. And so to go into this military lifestyle and learn everything I learned, and then be on this end of it, which, you know, I think you go in and you think, when people are in the military, you think, oh, a lot of them die. You know, that's what I thought. And here I am now. I'm like, no, this is really rare. And how crazy it is that I went from having never experienced the military in my life to now being on this end of being a Gold Star widow and being completely submerged. I'm the ideal person to write this book that bridges the gap between the civilian world, so a civilian can pick this book up and say, oh my gosh, this is what it's like to walk onto a military base for the first time. And this is the experience you will have. And this is what you'll feel and see. And this is what I can equate it to. And being able to take the military jargon, like the acronyms, and break those down. Because, I mean, honestly, even as I began to interview the men, they just speak that way. And as a military spouse, I mean, I imagine if I grew up in the military with a military parent, then maybe I would know some of these acronyms, but they're just throwing them out, you know, left and right. Oh, SIGINT, HUMINT, this, that. And I'm just going, okay, you know, in the EFON, and I'm just going, okay, you know, and I just recorded it all. And then later I'd call up sheepishly and, you know, well, what's EFON and what's SIGINT? And, you know, because some of the stuff I couldn't Google, and or I'd Google and it was wrong. You'd see like 20 different like military versions of this, but they were actually meaning something different. So yes, Google is not good for everything. No, teasing. But yeah, so this book, my goal was to, you know, bridge that gap between the military and the civilian world, so that civilian people could come in, read this book, and say, this is why this matters. This is why it matters when our military doesn't tell the truth, because this is what sacrifice actually looks like for these families. And also for those who are wondering, like, what really happened here? Because everything was bad Captain Perazzini And he is one of the best men I've ever met. And he was incredible at his job, still is. And there's a reason he still continues on at the job and gets promoted and overcomes all of these go-mores that they threw at him. There's a reason. It's because A, he did nothing wrong. And B, he's incredible at his job. He's a huge asset. And so my goal was to change it from bad Captain Parazzini and pull out the person who was responsible, Lieutenant Colonel Painter, and say, Niger does not fall on the head of Captain Parazzini. It falls on the head of Lieutenant Colonel Painter. And I wanted to paint, ironically, a very clear picture of why. And so I hopefully those are the two things I managed to do well.
Yeah, and I think you did those two things very well in the book. And it was really great to hear all the different sides of things. You know, when I first started listening to the book, I wasn't sure exactly the direction it was going to go in terms of you know, how in depth it was going to get in terms of the interview process that you did and learning about the actual details of what went on the ground during that mission from the people who were there. I wasn't sure if it was going to get into that, because you know, I know sometimes with the military, you don't exactly want to share some of that information, you know, especially when it's a maybe a contentious kind of thing, you know, that's going on, and investigations are happening and stuff. You may not necessarily want to share. So I wasn't sure what you were really going to get out of the guys who were there, but they gave you a lot, and that interview process got a lot of information out there. And as I was listening, I just kept finding myself thinking that I couldn't believe some of the failures in leadership that took place throughout the whole mission, or several missions that took place in that time period. But it got even worse when those same people were passing the buck down on the lower people down the chain of command and trying to pass the blame down. It just really just blew my mind that this type of thing would happen. You know, I've seen some bad leadership in the past in different stories, different examples that I've seen along the way, but I think this one takes the cake. This one was just, it was hard for me to just imagine that this is what happened. And I'm not doubting it in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying, like, it's just such a, such a terrible situation to have to have gone through. And you know, knowing, especially the guys who were on the ground, knowing that the mission wasn't a good mission, and they kept bringing it up to the chain of command, and it kept getting denied, and they still had to go out on these missions. It just baffles me.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think a lot of people look at the book, they look at the cover, and they say, oh, this is going to be a story on loss. And the first few chapters are, that's what it is. But I had to tell it in a way that was really chronological, because I wanted you to feel and see what we were going through as family members, as far as, okay, this is what we're being told. Okay, this is, and it kept changing. And I wanted you to see the realization as I hit that point where I'm being lied to in my brief, and I'm still holding on to hope. Like, okay, they're not going to punish anybody. This still isn't really making sense. I think they're lying to me, because the lawyer is talking over the actual investigating officer, which is not a good sign. And he's trying to do it in a sneaky way, like behind everyone's back, except I can see him. And I don't know if he realizes that. And so there were a lot of strange things going on, and that's why I walked it. The beginning was kind of a slow roll, is because I wanted everyone to kind of live it, so to speak. And that way you felt the frustration and that heartache over, like, just be honest, just tell us. And to lay it out the way they did, and then tell it the way that it actually happened, and do it minute by minute, as detailed as possible. That way, when you realize what happened, you're like me, where you see like, oh my gosh, this is a whole different story than what we were given, you know? And I think really it's like AFRICOM wanted us to focus so much on that first con op and then so much on not worrying about the mission they were sent on and whether it was a bad mission with bad intel and, you know, or lack of intel and bad, complete lack of assets and no real solid plans. They wanted us to not see that at all, but instead focus in on incremental things that they said Captain Parazini did wrong, which cost lives. And yeah, it was insane.
Go ahead. Yeah, it certainly was insane, you know, to read all of this or listen to all of this and hear all of the things that just went wrong. But another thing I think that the book did really well is it almost made you feel like you were there, like you can paint that picture in your head. And, you know, when you're talking about the things that were happening on the ground, you were talking about at one point they were lying, hiding because they only had, you know, limited ammunition between, you know, whoever was there. And they had a whole group of militants coming their way and they needed to basically just hide just to stay alive. And I could feel the stress of that situation, you know, just from the words that were coming out of the book. It was really incredible. And so I know that you did a lot of research and a lot of the interviews and everything, and you got it right. Like you got the information from the people who were there, because it really did feel like you were there when you're listening to the story being told, you know. And you're right, like they were trying to say that that this the team went rogue, that they were, you know, cowboys or, you know, flying off the hook or whatever, but these guys were highly trained Green Berets. And it's not to say that they couldn't have gone rogue, but that's not in the character of those people, you know, that's not what they do. And so it just really blew my mind to see that they were just so almost arrogant about saying how, you know, these guys were, they just went rogue and they didn't do their job and they didn't do what they were supposed to do. It just blew my mind to read that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it was crazy because, you know, they knew they could say that to the public and the general public is going to believe that because they don't really know or understand Green Berets. They don't understand that this isn't they enlisted and did 6 months of training. This is they enlisted, did 6 months of training. Now they've spent 3 years between SFAS going through, actually it's a lot more than 3 years, but, you know, going through the Q course, getting their Green Beret, and then, you know, all the extra training on top of that. By the time most of those guys are even the ones who are just on their first or second deployment, they are so well trained that it's insane. And you've got a master sergeant, you've got a, you know, team captain, you've got all these guys who obviously have longer careers too, who are sitting there and they've had, you know, 8, 10, 12 deployments under their belt. One of the guys on the team had been a Ranger and had, you know, had multiple deployments with Ranger Regiment under his belt before he came over to the Green Beret side. So it's just, you know, been in multiple combat deployments, been in multiple combat situations, had been shot twice before this trip. So it's just the fact that they're saying this team went rogue and that they weren't well trained, they were a bunch of cowboys, it was completely insane. And anybody who knew my husband also, we were just, there was no way. He was a chess master. He was a chess champion his whole life. I mean, he was second at nationals by the time he was 11 years old. He was a very methodical, very planned out thinker. And so to think that he would just decide to go rogue to hunt down a terrorist is laughable. So what you found were that these officers would say these things, and then as they would try and convince us, and I found out with the other families, same thing, as they tried to convince them, we're going, there's no way. So then their focus became, well, it was Captain Parazzini, which is great, except also Green Berets are not known to be followers. They have a real hard time following, you know, authority in general, especially like a brand new team captain. They would not all follow after a terrorist and, you know, well, going rogue. It just, all of it was crazy. And when, by the time I reached out to the guys, and this was how, really, I'm so grateful to them for trusting me and for telling me their story. One thing I do have to say is that the men on the team, you know, by the time I asked them, it was May. It was right after General Waldhauser had gone on and said that, you know, this team is not indicative of what special operators do. And it was at that point that I realized these men are all going to be blamed. And before I thought, well, as long as people aren't punished and we're, this is a learning experience, because at that point, I can't bring Brian back. I can't make this better. It's just, let's use it as a learning opportunity and make sure that in the future, if people are in this position, this doesn't happen again. We make better decisions. But after General Waldhauser said that, it occurred to me that all these guys are going to be punished. This isn't about learning anything. It's about covering for somebody. And I'm not even sure who they're covering right now. But I want to know, I still just want to know what happened to my husband. That's all I want. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the guys on the team, and by then they were looking at, they were hearing that they were going to be investigated once again. And this time they were going to have Article 15s coming their way, that kind of thing. And so they were being asked to interview once again about what happened on the ground with military officials. And so they were starting to lawyer up. And so that's when I talked to them and I was like, well, pretty soon your gag orders are going to lift. You're going to have media personnel coming in, media people coming in and wanting to get your story. They're going to want to write the book. I mean, everybody write, you know, there's a book on every story, right? Black Hawk Down, Lone Survivor, Benghazi, like someone's going to write the book. And someone's going to control that narrative. Do you want someone else? Do you trust someone else, or do you want to give it to me? Because I have no doubt I can do this. And I said, the difference between me and anybody else is I don't know what I'm doing. I have nothing to lose. And at this point, if you pull it out from under me in 2 years, that's fine, because I don't know if what I'm promising is possible. It's what I believe I can do. And so I'll keep these interviews here tucked away, and they are yours until the day I sign on with a publisher. And so that was kind of the agreement. And what the interviews ended up being was me just sitting down with the guys. And it was almost more like we just went through in depth, just discussing Brian and what they went through. And it was more of just a conversation than an interview. And I think that's why I, you know, ended up getting so much, because it did get really personal. You know, like, for instance, this flag in my background there, that's, it's smaller than all the other ones. It's actually, it was given to me by one of the guys who was back at the AOB during the whole thing on the ground. He was running communications, and he used to be with my husband on his team the first year they were out in Maradi Niger. And so Casey gave me this flag, and when we were interviewing, he was pretty upset. And I'm sure you remember the scene in the book where he's covering all the bodies. He's having to remove them. And he had a flag that his mom had given him. And he had served alongside my husband for so many years. And he was just falling apart. And as he told me this story over my kitchen table, I mean, Casey's like 6'4". You know, he's just a beast. And he is like, I'm like looking at him like he's one of my sons. He's just having such a hard time talking about it, and you know, and how much it affected him. And so he had covered Brian with this flag, and he didn't know what to do with it after that, because they had handed it back to him when the birds came and picked up the bodies and taken them to Germany. Or I guess back to the US, but they stopped in Landstuhl first to drop off the injured. Casey ended up bringing me that flag, and that flag still has all the dirt and dried blood, and you know, and so those were kind of the level of interviews. It was just different because I was Brian's wife, and in some ways I was doing it for them, but in other ways they were doing it for me. And so that's why that scene on the ground, I mean, I'm asking them things like, well, how many bullets did you have left? And I've got one of the machine gunner, one of the, weapons sergeants going, you know, one, two, he's counting on his hands. And then he goes about 100, and then he just loses it. And I just thought, oh my gosh, these guys have been through so much. It was about then that I realized they've probably been through far more than I have. And their grief is just as heavy as mine. And so writing those scenes, in many ways, I could just feel what they must have been feeling just sitting there, because watching them that day when I interviewed, you know, whichever guy, it just, you know, every time I'd bring the interviews back up, yeah, you could hear their emotion come across. And in writing that, I just thought, oh my gosh, these are the things that you don't hear about. You know, we all hear, oh, you know, the Alamo spot. You don't even think Alamo when you're talking about it, when you're reading it. It's just, they're literally hiding in a little divot of dirt being hunted.
Yeah. And that's exactly what they were dealing with. They were being hunted. The people who were coming after them were looking for them, and with only one intention. They weren't looking to, you know, take them out for coffee, or, you know, they were looking to kill them. That was it. And for people who are listening, who aren't really familiar with, the ammunition counts and things like that, 100 rounds is not a lot of ammunition to have, you know, especially when you're dealing with, it was somewhere around 80 to, there was a varying numbers of people that were coming after them, but there was,
my guess, you know, is that all told they were attacked by between 100 and 200 militants, and it's just kind of a moving number. No one will really say.
Yeah, so I mean, exactly. Even at one bullet per person, that they're still falling short in those estimates. And so, just the way firefights go, you don't always hit your target on the first shot, and sometimes you need more than one to take that target down. So, 100 rounds is not a lot of ammunition. And so, when they were down to that low, that's what we were talking about. When they're just hiding in that little divot, trying to go undetected, they were really there fearing for their lives, thinking that this probably was it, you know, right? Yeah. That's kind of the thought process that you're going through.
One of the guys told me that he had actually purposely saved a round in his pistol for himself so he wouldn't be taken, because he said, I'm more afraid of being captured. And you could tell by the way he told me that he just stopped, and he's like, I don't want to talk about that anymore. But he literally assumed that he was going to use his round. And I imagine there were probably a few of them doing that, just saving a round, because it was down to a point where they came, you know, face to face with them at one point. And I mean, they were within inches of being, all of them being killed by the time the planes came over.
Right. Yeah. That part, it was, the scene that I envisioned in my mind was almost like out of a movie, where it's like just moments before all hell broke loose, they were saved by the roaring of the jets flying overhead. And, you know, thank God that they were there, but it just seemed like it was so close, and it easily could have gone the other way for the people who did survive, had those jets not come, you know, and that would have been even bigger of a tragedy. Not to say that it wasn't a tragedy to begin with, but it could have been even worse.
I don't think any of them thought they were going to survive. And even now, they, as they interviewed with me and in the years since that we've talked, it just over and over, it was God. It was a miracle. There's no way we should be here still. And when, if you read the book and you read that part, that's why there's no way they should have survived, but they did.
One story from the book that stood out and made me actually smile a little bit was when President Trump called you and your family to offer his condolences, and your son's reaction to that. Could you share that story? Because to me, it was one of those lights in the whole, you know, bad situation. It was just, to me, it brought a smile to my face, saying, "Okay, you know, there's a little bit of good here, you know, coming out of this."
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, that was the year Trump was elected, and Zeke being autistic and being, he went to this like artsy school. So everyone was all about Hillary. And I remember him coming home and just, you know, "Mom, like, you know, I don't know what to think," basically. And Brian and I being like, personally, like, we're not big on voting. We hate politicians. But like, pick who you like. And then be totally shameless about it. Just who cares? Like, whether it makes you friends or not, just support them, love them, whatever. So he decided the memes were great, and all the Trump memes were like hilarious. So I think he must have been 10 when all this started. It was Trump, 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 Trump. And then that summer we went, and, you know, he was all about Trump. We were at DC, he wanted pictures in front of the Trump Hotel. So 11 years old, you know, Brian was killed, and Zeke is on the phone with Trump. And it was just so funny. He was very awkward, but it was, "Yes, Mr. President," and "Yes, sir." And it was so cute. And so I told President Trump, I said, "You know, we're going to be in Arlington. We're going to be burying Brian there. And Ezekiel would give anything to stay at your hotel. We can't afford it, but we would love that." So he gave us a couple nights at his hotel, which was just amazing. I think it was the one in a bright spot in everything. And we also were given a like private tour of the White House, where we were able to go anywhere we wanted. We could lift any of those red, or the, what are they? The little things that
the rope that block off.
Yeah, the ropes. Yeah. So we were moving the ropes and moving all this stuff, and we had our own, and we had the president's football, the military aid to the president. So he was with us, showing us around and giving us like the military history. And then we had an actual White House historian with us who was amazing. Wow. And he was showing us everything. And, you know, so yeah, we just saw amazing stuff. We didn't see Trump, but we did see Pence, and we talked to him for a minute and got to go into, you know, the West Wing and the Eisenhower building and all the offices. And it was just, you know, I wouldn't say it made it better, but it made it less bleak, you know?
Yeah. I mean, nothing can make it better. I mean, it's a bad situation, and it's a tragedy for you and your family. But the thing that made me smile was, you know, the whole backstory with how your son, you know, came to support Trump in his own way, you know, which was kind of cute in its own way, because it, you know, a kid in politics, and, you know, most adults don't understand politics, and so just how he decided that was kind of funny. But then you know, I know kids look up to all sorts of people, sports figures, you know, things like that, movie stars, all sorts of things like that. But then to be able to speak to that person who he was looking up to on the phone is, just something that just brought a smile to my face. Like that's just cool, you know, being able to do that. Cause not everyone gets that opportunity and he did. And then you guys got to stay in the hotel in DC and everything as well. And that probably just was the icing on the cake for him as well, you know?
It was. So,
yeah. which that was an eventful experience as well, but I'm not going to get too much into that. I'll let people read the book and find out more about that, that experience. But, in addition to everything that we've talked about today, I think it's important to be able to give you the opportunity to share a little bit about your husband, about who he was, the type of person he was, not necessarily who he was as a soldier and what happened in his final days, but who he was as a person. Could you tell us a little bit about Brian?
Yeah. Brian, I actually did a post about him this morning because I was like, all you need to do is look at the bookshelf and you'll find Brian, right, you know, like the big boss, the big book of combat for boss rootin'. And I was telling the kids the other day at jiu-jitsu, you know, his favorite thing before open mat was to find some new offensive move from the big book and go try it. Like one day he told me, yeah, I managed to like find this move where I'm choking a guy out and my butt is in his face the whole time. I'm like, great, cool. And you're like 30. But you know, like just silly. He was a prankster and but really intelligent. You know, he was always working on something, so highly motivated. I always find lists around the house still. I keep all his old like write on the rain, write in rain notebooks. And so he'd write things from like, spend more time with the family, prioritize family time, you know, prioritize skills, like less grand schemes, more practical. I mean, like total, just funny notes to himself, but they were good, you know? So like the last year of his life, he created a stock trading algorithm. And I still have that with stocks being crazy right now, it's not very usable. But back when they were more consistent, it was amazing. So hopefully when things even out, I'll be able to use it. But he, you know, taught himself Hausa, taught himself, which is the local dialect in Niger, taught himself French. And then anything I wanted or whatever, like I wanted this walk-in closet in Fayetteville. So he went through and bought himself. I have tons of books on, you know, building custom cabinetry, and he bought himself all the tools. And the next thing you know, he's building custom cabinets for me. So that was him. Hours spent out sharpening tools while drinking beer out in his shed. And he's made like all these schematics for how he's gonna, you know, make the shed bigger and make it into a perfect shed with all these perfect tables. And, but that's what I remember is him sharpening things while drinking beer and telling him that it wasn't safe and him thinking I was being like ridiculous. So, yeah. And then he would constantly be cooking. So he'd smoke all this stuff in the smoker all night and be out roasting his own coffee beans. So yeah, Brian was kind of a jack of all trades.
It sounds like it. Yeah. I mean, I don't know when he had time to even go to Africa with all the things that he had been doing.
You know? I feel like I never saw him. He was always, you know. But what was funny is anytime the office door was shut or cracked, you know, I'd be like, what are you doing up there? And he'd respond, nothing. And I'm like, you're playing chess again. And that was like our constant issue. It was like, you're playing chess again. Get off the chess games.
Funny. Yeah. So. Yeah. And when you guys first met, you know what? I'm not even going to get into that. People, if you want to know more about their story and the background of, you know, how Michelle and Brian met and everything, read the book. Read the book Sacrifice. I think it's a great read. And I think you do a good job of telling who he was and what he meant to you and your family in the book. And it really makes you feel like you feel the loss as well. Obviously not the same that you and your family has felt, but you feel sadness when that battle is taking place, and it really does kind of affect you as well. And I think that that's important for the people who might read this book, especially the civilians who maybe don't understand the the impact of people going overseas and serving and being willing to give their lives and sacrifice for other people. It really does drive it home. And I think that, like I said, this book did a lot of things well, and that's just another one of them. I think, it really does make you feel the emotion of that loss.
Yeah. I'm glad, and just, a sidebar, because as you were starting to say, when we first met, I tell all about, how like he was kind of like crazy and tense and all this stuff. And I was thinking about it the other day. And one story I didn't tell anybody about, and I didn't write in there, was about how I ended up in that ski town where we met. Okay. I had actually interviewed for a job and with my degree. So I was going to be working in greenhouses, which were large growing greenhouses in Southern California for cut flowers. And they said, okay, you need to sign on for 5 years. And I was like, really, 5 years? I don't think I can do that. So I packed my snowboard bag. And my grandparents were going up to that ski area, to Mammoth Lakes, that night. And I caught a ride with them. Oh, the next morning they were going up, and I just had them drop me off in town, and I walked up with my snowboard bag, got hired at the mountain as an instructor, and then walked back into town. I had an uncle in town, so I went to his apartment, and he wasn't home, so I fell asleep on the washer and dryer. And his girlfriend found me and was like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I don't really have anywhere to live. And I figured I could stay with Uncle Steve. And I said, but then I saw he has a huge dog in there and he's not here and I don't have keys. So she ended up taking me home with her, and letting me stay with her in her son's apartment or her son's room because he had left. And so I got to live with her until I finally met some friends and could kind of be a little more stable and eventually bring my car up. But yeah.
Yeah, a whole series of events that took place to make it possible for the two of you to meet. And there's other stories too, that took place throughout your time together. And, I think people should definitely get the book and read it and learn some of those stories through that. But it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. It really has. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to have you on and share your story and your husband's story. I could probably talk to you for a few more hours about your story in the book, but like I said, I don't want to give it all away. I want people to go out and get the book. So where can people go to get a copy of the book
So let me first pull this down so people can see a picture of it. But sure. This is, hopefully it's not too bad of a glare. So Sacrifice. No, and you can find it really anywhere books are sold. On Amazon, there is the Kindle version. There is the Audible version. There is hardback. We'll have paperback out in the spring with a new cover. You can find it, Barnes & Noble usually has them in stock in stores, in, I believe, the biography section. And then you can go to michelleblacksacrifice.com, and I have a whole list. Or you can, and of course, follow me on any social media, michelleblack71, or on Facebook, author Michelle Black. So, yeah.
I will have links to all of this in the show notes. So anyone who's looking to pick up a copy of the book, either on Amazon or elsewhere, I'll have those links available and you can click through and get the book. You can also follow Michelle on social media. Definitely encourage you to do that and keep up with what she's up to and what she's been doing. I actually saw your post earlier today about the bookcase in the background here. And so anyone who's not watching this on YouTube, you just have to imagine a big bookcase behind her right now, or just go to YouTube and watch the video and see it. But I really appreciated you sharing that part of your life as well, with all the things that Brian had left behind and all the things that he had accumulated throughout his life, and not just physical books, but the knowledge that he accumulated. It was interesting to see that as well.
Yeah. I mean, as my post said, our favorite date was to go to a used bookstore and peruse the nonfiction section.
That's great.
So yeah, we did that too much. We have too many old books laying around the house now, but yeah.
Well, you can never have too many. So it's always good. And you can always pass some of that knowledge down to the younger generation as well. So, yeah. So anyways, thank you again for joining me. I really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. I really appreciate you having me on. I love getting to talk about this and about Brian. And, you know, it's a huge honor that the men both trusted me with this story and that, you know, that I'm the one who gets to tell it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you did a great job telling it. And I look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.